Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview that I did with Carol Kleinberg. Carol is a director. She always knew she was a director, and even though she had to fight some family encouragement, or should I say discouragement, she found a way to be what she always knew she was and make a life of it. I'm also telling my holiday story, which I tell every year. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh, I really can. Oh, I really can. Turn down all the noise so I can hear that sweet voice sing. Oh, you really can.
Hello. Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about discovering and becoming who you really are. If you've been listening, you know that I believe that we're all pretending to be something less than what we really are. That we learn as children some qualities which are the ones that are acceptable, or the ones that are desirable, or the ones that are going to cause us the least trouble, get us into the least trouble, are the least threat to us in some cases. And we lead with those qualities. We present those qualities. Those qualities are true of us, but they're not the whole truth. Because in addition to those things which we are presenting, which I have labeled our cover story, much as a spy has a cover story, which is not actually the true representation of who they are, and which they pretend is true in order to stay safe. I think that's the same reason that we lead with our cover story. But while the spy is pretending to the rest of the world and really knows the truth, we start out pretending to the rest of the world, and after a while we get so good at the pretending that we too believe that we are only our cover story, only what we are presenting. But that is almost always only part of the truth. There are qualities, skills, abilities, memories, ideas, ways of being that we have hidden under cover. The more that you were exactly like the child your parents wanted and needed you to be, the less you had to hide. The less you were like the child your parents wanted you or needed you to be, the more you had to hide. So, sometimes some very important things about us get hidden, what I call undercover. So then we have our cover story, which we're presenting to the world and which we actually believe to be the truth. And then we have our undercover, which contains sometimes, as I said before, some really important qualities which we may need, may be very useful to us as we grow and when we're older. But since we have hidden them so deeply inside, we don't have access to them. And more to the point, because they would have embarrassed us, gotten us in trouble, even provided a threat to us when we were young, we come to think of these qualities as dangerous. And so even if we could get access to them, we don't want them. We think of them as dangerous or ugly. And one of the best ways to tell whether you've got a quality undercover is it's a quality you really find disgusting in another person when you see it. So, you know, if you are a neat person, very, very neat, everything has a place and everything is in its place, you know, and people who are sloppy really make you uncomfortable. You're incredibly judgmental about them. You think they're really bad, bad, flawed. Something very bad about sloppy people. Well, if you have a really intense, passionate dislike for sloppiness, then I'm so sorry to tell you, the chances are good that undercover you have the capacity to be sloppy. Oh my God. Well, and the important thing about this is that there are times when it is best not to have to worry about being neat, to be able to accept being sloppy sometimes. I know you know that. But if the quality really got you in trouble as a kid, then the chances are you can't be sloppy, even when your life would call for that ability. I've been talking a lot about this in the last, month or so, and I will continue to talk about it. But again, if you've been listening, you know that another thing that I do in this show is I interview people who make their living and or their life with their art. And in this show, I'm playing an interview I did with director, teacher, person who is sensitive to the accidents in life, Carol Kleinberg. She has a really interesting story, and Carol demonstrates really clearly the capacity to know what is inside of you and to continue to lobby for it, to continue to try and make it real in your life. And Carol has been doing this really all her life, and it has been real. It has become her life. It's an inspiring story for those of us who are trying to find our real self. So, here, Carol Kleinberg. Okay, so I'm here with Carol Kleinberg. So I interview people who make their living or their life with their art. Mm-hmm. My question is, how did it happen? How did it find you? How did you find it?
My mom was a band singer.
She's beautiful.
Yeah, and an actress. But, of course, she stopped working professionally when she got married because nice
Jewish
girls.
She did. Yeah.
Didn't do it. Grandma was Florence Ziegfeld's accompanist when Florence Ziegfeld was in Chicago.
Wow.
And she came down here, and she was the musical director she was the organist for Temple Beth Sholem.
Yeah.
And she produced temple shows and worked in the community.
So it's third generation entertainment, too.
Right, right.
Right, women in theater.
Right.
Wow.
And You want the whole gory story? All
right. I do.
So I was, my sister is an actress.
Make sure we get it, yeah? Older or younger?
Younger.
Mm-hmm. So you're the oldest?
Yes. And she's in L.A., and the musical gene skipped me. three generations of musicians, but not me. So I was going to college, and I was majoring in journalism, because that's what my mother said I should be. I'm a good writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't happy.
Oh.
And I had adolescent angst, and I dropped out of college in my end of my sophomore year, and I came down here to stay with my grandmother, and I walked the beach every day, walked Lido.
Wow.
Trying to work out my adolescent angst.
Right.
And I went back to college, and I changed my major to theater, because that's what I wanted to do. My father said I was going to starve. Be a teacher.
Yeah.
I don't want to be a teacher. I want to do my theater. So
I'm just curious. Did they do that to your sister as well?
No. You could see her art.
Yeah, right.
And you couldn't see mine.
Right.
And so...
This is really important for me. I mean, how you... Given that they couldn't see it and there was discouragement, really...
Oh, yeah.
That you were as keenly aware of it, that you knew that you didn't fit in this other thing.
Mm-mm.
You know, that you had the dark night of the soul, really, and then took the risk, right? That's amazing.
Yeah, and it was. And so, because I switched in my junior year, I only had the basic courses, so I had to go to graduate school in order to get what I needed to do what I want to do.
Well, and did you know what you wanted to do then?
Never wanted to act. I wanted to direct, and that's what I started out doing. Then, after I got through with college, my first job was as the front desk girl for... an agent and producer in Chicago. And he produced musicals. It was just Phil and Melba Consolo. They were a big dance act. And they produced the show at the Shaperie in Chicago. So I got to meet... I wished Sammy Davis Jr. Happy Hanukkah on his first Hanukkah as a Jew. So Shaperie was the
big
club.
Right.
So I got to work with really big people. But I was the girl at the front desk.
Right.
And it was valuable lessons to me, really, about when the boss would say to me, give me 10 girl next doors,
right,
and I had all the pictures,
right.
Well, who, you know, and I had 100 girl next doors in the drawer, who were the 10 next doors I pulled?
Right.
They were the girls who I had a relationship with, who were nice.
Right.
Not the ones who brought an apple, but the ones who spent a little time schmoozing.
Yeah.
And also the ones who weren't nice were not...
They didn't
get pulled. So it was an interesting life lesson.
No kidding.
Yeah.
You learned what worked.
Mm-hmm. And then I went... Do you know who Avery Schreiber is?
I do.
Avery was in Chicago, and he and I performed Hole in the Head at a theater. He was... Because I was always chubby. He was the father and I was the mother. And we were both... early 20s, and so we formed an acting company, and we had an acting company for several years. It was very successful on the near north side of Chicago on Division Street in the back of a bar. We took the back party room of a bar and made a theater, and then I decided I needed to go to graduate school, and he was really angry because we always got to play the mother and the father. So I went to the University of Miami for graduate school, and he went to L.A., and the rest is history,
right? Did you like acting?
I was always an okay actress. I'm still an okay actress, but it's not where my heart is.
Yeah, right.
I like, maybe I'm a control freak. I like the big picture. I love being able to shape the whole thing and see it turn out and to put my own flavor into it. And I can tell you about some of that. I can talk from now till tomorrow.
So you went off to Miami to
graduate school. Right. And then in the middle of that, somehow got married. And I didn't finish graduate school. And every time I went back, I was pregnant. Because I had enough finished. I only needed 9 more hours, and only 9 would transfer. So I had to go back down to Miami to finish. and I registered, and I was pregnant.
Oh, my gosh.
And then the next year, I registered, and I was pregnant. So it took me a long time to finish.
Well, you were busy creating other things.
Right. And so, and then I was, and a lot that happened in my life is an accident.
Tell me.
I was in Chicago. I had my babies.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a very dear friend who called up, and she said, they're starting a community college a half a mile from your house. Well, they started it, and she taught there the first semester, and she said, they want to add some theater courses, and I told them about you. Why don't you come down and talk to them? So I went half a mile from my house, and I went and had a chat with the academic vice president, and we talked about children's theater and academic, and we had a nice chat, and mm-hmm. I left, and I never gave it a second thought.
Mm-hmm.
And then he called me, and he said, you have the job. Okay. And he said, you start, this was probably in November, he said, you start the beginning of January with the new semester. Okay. And he said, I want you to build a theater department. I said, okay. And then, oh, God, my second semester was summer, walking into school at 8 o'clock in the morning. I'm going down the hall. He's coming down this way, he passes me, gets to the door, and he turns around, and he says, oh, Kleinberg, we canceled your classes. Okay. He said, you're teaching two modern culture and the arts instead.
Oh, dear.
What's
culture and the arts?
I don't know what this is. So I went and looked to see when the classes were, and then I went to the bookstore, and I bought some index cards, and I went to the library and looked up the word culture. And I went back and...
So you invented it?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
I invented everything. So I went back and I passed out index cards. What do you want from this course?
Very smart.
I didn't know what else to do. So I did that, and then we built a theater department that is a wonderful, strong theater department today. I mean, it's flourishing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really proud of the work I did there. We've got a gorgeous theater now. We've got a black box theater up there. I directed a couple of plays that were award-winning plays. I'm very proud of The Elephant Man with a Black John Merrick.
Wow.
And it added
Yes.
It was wonderful. And I did Diary of Anne Frank, and I had a beautiful cast for that. And my concept was I had a film student come and do slides of what was happening. Well, the opening slides were the girls growing up, because Otto Frank was quite a prolific photographer.
And you mean, so you had those photographs?
I had them. I had bought a book when I was in Europe that wasn't available in the United States. And then I had a photography student from Columbia College in Chicago put together a slideshow, archival photos of what was going outside while they were inside.
Inside, yeah.
And so with each, because there's 10 scenes, with each scene change, we sequenced
it's
slides.
Getting, right.
And then we would freeze on the slide, for instance, when they heard the outside noises of the SS.
Right.
I had an SS guard getting out of his car.
Ooh,
in the slides.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I bet it was really powerful.
And then the final slides were Bosnian refugees, and they were in boxcars. And it's Isaac Rabin's funeral.
Mm. Mm.
And the fireman with the baby.
Yeah, yeah.
In Oklahoma.
Right.
Because I wanted to pull it to it's still happening.
Right. It's still happening, right.
And it was so powerful. But what was so interesting was one of the actors dropped out. He came, he was doing badly. He was just, every rehearsal he got worse and worse and worse. And finally I decided I had to bump him. And he came to me the day I was going to dump him, and he said, Carol, I have to talk to you. I have to pull out of the play. I said, why? He said, well, my father said if I continue to play a Jew, I can no longer sleep in his house.
Oh, my God.
Right, in the Chicago North Shore suburbs.
Wow.
So I said, would you come tonight and talk to the cast about it?
Yeah.
And tell them why? Inside I'm going, yes.
Yeah, right.
But I was shocked.
No kidding.
You know?
Yeah.
And
well, and this probably had some impact on his capacity to do the role.
This is a Polish kid whose father was a Polish immigrant.
Right.
And that's why it kept getting worse and worse.
Yeah,
and worse
I'm sure.
So when he opened the conversation at rehearsal, the girl who's playing Mrs. Frank said, well, you know, we've been talking about this a lot in my house because my grandfather was an SS guard.
Oh, my God.
And the girl who's playing Anna said, well, we've been talking about it a lot in my house, too, because we're German. Oh. And the guy who's playing Mr. Dussel says, well, yeah, we've been talking about it in my house, too, because my in-laws are survivors.
Oh, my God.
So we never had a rehearsal that night. We just sat and talked.
Right. About the amazing, amazing coincidence of all these people.
And the impact on our personal lives.
Right, exactly.
And so then I had each person write a paragraph of what the Holocaust experience was personally to them.
Yeah, they all had it.
And we went in and we put this black photographer's paper around one of the kiosks in the student center and we stuck their headshots and all of our paragraphs went up.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, yeah. I did this cool thing. Well, I think I put it up on Friday. Monday, I come into school, Monday, probably walked in Monday afternoon, and there's notes. It was like a chat room before chat rooms. There's notes from kids in school.
Oh my God.
About their reaction to it. So this thing just cascaded in such wonderful, unpredictable ways.
Right. And also unintentional.
Yeah. And I love that.
Me too.
I love that when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
So and it happens a lot. As long as the environment is set for that kind of freedom
and open to it.
And yes. That just wonderful unexpected things happen.
Yeah.
And it's a joy in life.
I know.
That this happens. So and being down here. I came down. I knew I wanted to live here. I had a house. My daughter had moved here. She's an attorney here in town. She had moved here when she got out of law school because she said, I'm not going to wait like you, Mom. I'm going to start my life where I want to live. And so I came down and I went into the Oslo and I said, could you use an old intern? And I sat and talked to Bruce a while, Bruce Rogers, and I talked to Howard Millman a while. And Bruce said, well, leave your resume and we'll let you know. That's what they said. I know now. When I walked out, they went, yes!
Right.
Because that was at the point where they were having such
Yeah, they terrible were in trouble. They needed help.
And to have someone come in with my experience
right.
and say, I'll come in free for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, right.
Right, what can
right.
I do?
Right. It's like a gift from God.
Right.
Right.
That's what happened. It was a gift from God for them.
Right.
And then I fell in love with Kaleidoscope. Mm-hmm. With the music theater program for developmentally disabled adults.
Annie Morrison.
And Annie. I fell in love with Annie.
Yeah.
She's one of my best friends now. Mm-hmm. And so I came down a couple summers and I volunteered for Kaleidoscope in the summer. And I did the year here and then I wrote study guides long distance, just not getting paid for it. I just did it.
Right.
It's that same kind of thing. It's like the girl at the front desk.
Yes.
I just did it.
Right.
And their education, they decided to hire an education director and called and offered me the job, but I was in a position where I had to give 2 years' notice to retire.
From school?
From school.
Ah, ooh.
I have a contract, and
right,
it's a two-year
right.
contract. And so they offered me the job, and I said, I can't take it.
Right.
And then the next, whoever they hired didn't work out, they offered to me the next year. And I went and looked at it, and it would have cost me $6,000 a year for the rest of my life, compounded by 3% a year. I can't do
right.
it.
Right.
So I turned it down again. Then I decided I was going to retire because I couldn't stand grading papers anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so I put into my retirement to take effect August 1st, 1999.
Mm-hmm.
On July 13th, 1999, Bruce called me and he said, look, our education director just gave us 2 weeks' notice. We know you want to be here. You know we want you. We're offering you the job and you can't turn it down.
And you said, it just happens.
I said, when do you want me to start? And he said, August 1st.
Right.
I said, okay.
Yeah. As it happens.
I said, could I start August 2nd, one day of retirement? Mm-hmm. So they said yes, and I came down, and I started. I worked the rest of the summer, Kaleidoscope, and then I went back and sold my house. Mm. And it was like I walked around for a month going,
how did this happen?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because it was,
yeah,
you know.
Bashert.
Yeah, it was a Bashert. It was, how do these things, it's some greater good, some God working, you know, not some old guy with a white beard in heaven, but there's a force for good in the universe that I believe in.
And your life seems to suggest is working.
It does.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I'm here in this beautiful house that has generations of
of
good feeling.
Yes.
And my daughter bought the house next door.
Oh. Yeah. Well, we have the grandchildren outside playing. That's
Right. So it's wonderful. The grandchildren run in and out.
In and out. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
So now, I know you're doing the Banyan.
Okay. Now. So I was at the Oslo, and I wasn't living the life I wanted to live there. I built a wonderful program. I'm very proud of the work I did. I started the Spotlights, which they didn't have that audience information.
Mm-hmm. News right.
I started that. I built, the first year I was there, we had 1,400 kids and I think 22 teachers. And the year I left, we had just under 7,000 kids and 120 teachers.
Wow.
So I was very proud of what I built. I did family theater workshops. I started the adult education courses. But I was spending my life in an office. And I did the discussion series there and the talkbacks, and that was fun. But it was like, do I do
my turn?
What really makes me happy?
Right.
And so I gave them notice at the Oslo, and it was a loving parting, and I still am. I do things there, and I'm involved there, and everything's good.
Right.
But I needed, and it's always these leaps of faith, this making the decision to walk through a door when you don't know what's on the other side of it that is so scary. Like making the decision to retire from the college when I had no idea where I was going to end up on the other end.
Right.
But I knew that I couldn't do that anymore. And when I left the Oslo, it was the same thing. I want to direct. That's what I love doing.
Yeah.
What this is
that you know yourself and you act on that knowledge.
It takes me a while, but yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, so many people don't know, and even if they do, they don't act. So, I mean, you know, that it takes you a while is okay.
But that other life lesson, the walk through the door, even though you don't know what's on the other side, and trust that it's going to be okay.
Yeah, and it is.
And it is. And
so have you been directing? I mean, I know you're directing now.
I left and I directed at the Players. I directed several of the straight plays at the Players. And then I did the Anna Maria Playhouse. I did two plays up there. And I did Venice and I did Lemon Bay Playhouse.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a circuit rider. And then when Gil Lazier was the artistic director, they moved to Arizona. One of the board members at Banyan is a friend, Eva Slane.
Mm-hmm.
And Eva said to Jerry, call Carol.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I never in a million years thought that they would hire me.
Well, of course.
Yeah, right.
right.
But I went over there and to chat with Sherry, and I had a plan with me when I went in for plays I would like to do and things I would like to see the Banyan do. And
he liked it.
And it was kind of like that conversation with the guy at the college. It was like, okay, well, we're doing it.
Right.
Oh, okay. And so, and then last year, Jeff Kinn called me.
Mm-hmm.
He called me and he said, do you want to direct Little Women? musical? The musical gene skipped me. Now, early in my career, I skipped that part. Because I was so dumb when I got out of college, I formed a production company and I wrote and toured musicals through the Midwest.
I see.
Why not? Right. You know, musical reviews.
Right.
Because my sister was there and she was a singer.
Right. So you used her.
Of course. She was a star.
Right.
So that's the only musical I've ever done was those musical reviews. Oh, and that was that was an interesting story, too. Anyway, those musical reviews, I never have directed a musical.
Mm-hmm.
So Jeff said, do you want to, I use music in my plays all the time, but that's different. I said, okay, as long as I have a really good musical director and a good choreographer, and I asked for Jimmy Hoskins, who's the best in town, and he was the choreographer, and...
Who musical directed it?
Joyce Valentine. It was so good. I was so pleased.
So are you saying that you directed it like a straight play, but mm-hmm. you allowed these other professionals who knew what they were doing to support with the...
We did it the other way around. First of all, we made the decision together. Are we going to cast this as actors or as...
Yes, actors who can sing or singers who can act.
And we made the decision with this show it had to be singers who can act. And I know enough about myself that I can usually make wallboard act.
So if you got singers, really who were really good singers who could sort of act, you could really get it from
right.
them.
Right. So we did that, and they structured the musical parts.
Mm-hmm.
And then I...
You structured the acting.
And I structured the acting, and then I shaped it and paced it.
Right.
And it, I was so...
You loved it, right?
I couldn't believe... Because I had seen the show, the Broadway show,
mm-hmm.
and hated it.
Ooh. Wow.
And I hated it because Maureen McGovern was the mother.
Oh.
And they made the mother the star. Well, it was
right.
upside down.
Right.
And I had a wonderful, wonderful cast. In that show, the actors... There are scenes where they act out her stories, Louisa May Alcott's stories. And they made that so hyper-dramatic that they weren't stories. They lost it lost its perspective for what it was supposed to be within the whole piece.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to shift that around so that clearly this was her telling her imagination, making it happen on the stage.
Right.
And so I think what we ended up with was a piece that had more integrity than what I saw on Broadway. I was very pleased. So now I'm doing my second musical.
Oh, what?
Fiddler on the Roof. And Joyce is musical director again. I have a different choreographer, and she's wonderful. And we're going to make Fiddler happen. and my intention with Fiddler is the same thing. It's going to be a play with music. It's not going to be broad comedy.
Right, right.
It's going to
come from the heart.
We've already had the conversation that the center of this play is love. It's love of family, love of community, love of tradition.
Right.
That's the center. And that's the concentric circles that we go from. And all of our staging is going to be kind of circles. The concentric circles are going to be always based in love.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be a cool.
It's lovely experience. To hear you talk about it because I can see when I listen to you the pleasure that you get from the putting together the putting of it together.
Right.
You know.
Which is why I'm not an
excited
actor. About acting.
No, of course not, because then you'd only be one piece of it.
Right.
This way. You have all the pieces to play with, and you can. It's almost like a jigsaw puzzle.
It is exactly like a jigsaw puzzle.
Right, and yeah, it's great.
And you don't get to see it until the last piece
is in. That's exactly right.
And the last piece is the audience.
Wow.
There's no theater without an audience.
No, clearly.
So that's the last piece, and that's always so exciting
to see it fit.
Yeah. I had talked about my accidents in life.
Yes.
I formed this musical touring company. And we toured through the Midwest, and we were doing pretty well because I had really good people in it. And we were doing so well, I went out and had new arrangements made, and I bought new costumes, and we went off, and I think we were at the Brown Hotel in St. Louis. And my agent ran away with our money. He disappeared with all of our money.
Jeez.
He disappeared.
Right. It's an old story.
And we're in the hotel, and we have no money.
Oh, my God.
He's taken all the paychecks, and he's gone. So I called my lawyer, and my lawyer came down and bailed
you out.
Right.
Right. This is that old story, ahead of the sheriff, right?
Right. And this is winter time, we were in St. Louis in the winter. I had had a friend from Tampa, a nephew of a friend of my mother's, a Cuban young man, he came up to Chicago over Christmas break. He'd never seen snow. It didn't snow, of course, but he came up and he applied for a job for the state of Illinois. So I took him down to take the test. So I said, I'm going to sit there all day. I took the test, too.
Right.
Never gave it another thought. Went off.
The test for what?
For a job with the Illinois State Employment Service. Illinois Job Service. I go off with my company. Right.
Right.
We're getting stranded.
Right.
I come back, and I've got the bills from... And I got a letter saying, you got a
job.
For Illinois Job Service. Professional, okay, all right. So I went down and I took the job. Well, I got in there, and the things I do, the director of the office noticed that I didn't fit really well during job interviews.
Right.
So she made me the media specialist for the office, and I did all of the flyers and the advertising.
Yeah, the marketing.
All of it.
Right.
Okay. So.
Right.
And I got my bills paid off.
Right. And that's a skill which you would later use.
Right. Mm-hmm. All the pieces fit together.
That's right.
Everything.
This is a great story. I love this story.
So my life is like putting a play on. It's all the pieces.
All the pieces,
yeah.
Right. Right.
And then, of course, the way it was supposed to happen, my husband and I were supposed to enjoy this together, and he had a heart attack and died before we moved down.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. And so I got down here, and I didn't have that
support
piece of my good life that I thought I was going to have.
Yeah.
So a couple of years ago, I decided I wanted to meet somebody to go with me to these events, and because I was going alone.
Right.
So I have a girlfriend here in theater, and she said, you have to do Match.com. I said, I'm not going to do Match.com. She said, no, you have to do Match.com. So, okay, I'll look.
Right.
So I went on Match.com, and
right.
I looked, and there's a guy in Sarasota whose profile starts, I'm a true Renaissance man, I love live theater, and he's saying all these things that are...
Yeah.
So I wrote him an email.
Right.
And he wrote me back. And we've been together ever since.
Oh, my God.
And he's... amazing, wonderful, kind, loving man who loves theater as much or more than I do, who's seen everything. he tells about his first play he ever saw at 15, took a bus by himself from a town in Pennsylvania and went to see West Side Story. He said when Leonard Bernstein came out of the pit.
With that hair.
Yes, he said, I was
hooked.
Forever, right,
right.
So I've got that piece now. I've got my kids here, and I'm going to Chicago in 2 weeks. My grandson in Chicago he's 10. He's going to play Gaston in Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, my God.
So I have to go see that.
Yeah.
And my daughter-in-law's parents just bought a house down here. So.
Yes.
We're here.
It's lovely. It's a lovely, lovely, lovely story.
Yeah.
So I always ask people, the thrust of the show I do is, its intention is to help people to discover and become who they really are.
Oh, okay.
And I interview people who make their life or their living with their art, because you can't do that unless that's actually who you really are. Mm-hmm. And your story is over and over and over again about the deep connection that you have to who you are and how you trust it. It's the perfect story for me. I mean, so so I'm thrilled.
It's not without getting scared and making...
Well, actually, I think this addresses the question. The last question I usually ask is, what do you have to say about what it means to live, to devote a life to an art?
Oh, my goodness. I can't imagine having lived another way. I know my dad said, he said, you're going to starve.
Yeah.
You're going to starve. Yeah, this is ridiculous.
Right.
And I've earned a wonderful living.
Mm-hmm.
I directed everything I ever wanted to direct.
Wow.
And I never worried about a budget at the college. I had the privilege of shaping.
Yeah. Of doing what you love to do.
Lives, though, also.
Yeah. Ah.
Of giving this gift to other people.
Yes.
As a teacher, which my father said I should be, which I said I would never do. But I had an experience with one student that, because as part of our theater department, we were also speech. And so I always taught one class of public speaking. And I had a student who came to me, and she said, I've taken this class, I've registered for this class 6 times, and I've dropped it 6 times. I can't pass it, and it's a requirement to get your degree in Illinois.
Aye.
She said, I can't pass the class. I said, yes, you can.
Mm-hmm.
She said, no, I can't do it. She said, and this is my last semester.
Oy.
And I'm not going to graduate if I don't have this class. I said, tell you what, register for the class, and come into my office every day before class, and we'll talk a little bit about what you're going to be doing, and you will be fine. And she not only was fine, she got an A. She had the highest grade in the class. She was brilliant. She was phenomenal. And I talked her through it was about the fear.
Right.
Which
right.
is where I'm, for me, where I have to go. And she was so fearful, she was almost paralyzed, and we talked through it, and she got through the semester, and the end of the semester she came with a box, last day of class, came to my office with a beautiful gift box, and I said, I can't take any gifts, and she said, no, you have to take this. I said, your success in this class is gift enough, I can't take any gifts. She said, it's not a bought gift, it's a made gift, you have to take it. I opened up the box, and it was, she knitted an afghan. She went home after every class and knitted one square.
Oh, my God.
So it was her whole
semester.
I still have the afghan.
I'll bet.
I'll take that. It was, so she could see her progress.
Right.
And
so can you,
and so
every
can
day.
I, every day. But, you know, I touched that life.
Yes.
And as a teacher, and as a director, you get to nurture the creativity in other people, and help actors find their strength. I get emails from all these kids all the time. I got one yesterday. Now they find me on Facebook. I've got one, Anne Frank. Oh no, the girl who played Meep in there was an exchange student from Germany, and now she's teaching in Germany, and she emails me. There's the joy that's come to me, but it wouldn't have come if I hadn't been able to walk through that fear myself.
Yes.
The day I put in for my the college thing, you have to give them 2 years.
Right.
And then after a year out, there's a point where the board approves your disconnection.
Yeah. Your, they say, okay, we'll let you go.
Your retirement. They it's a board approval process. I was in Spain with a girlfriend during that period of time. For the 3 days, the day before, the day of, and the day after, I threw up for 3 days.
Yeah.
I was so panicked about the idea of leaving the safety
right.
t- to go, I don't know.
Right.
And literally threw up for 3 days.
Yeah. It's the willingness, really, to risk what you know you have to have, even if it's terrifying.
You have to do it.
You have
right.
to do it. And that's why I interview people like you, because that is how you know who you are, because you have to do it.
Right. And I always tell my acting students that if there's anything else you can do that doesn't make you want to throw up,
right.
go do it.
Right.
But if there isn't anything else that you can do, then you go be an actor or a director or whatever it is, you go do your art, but find another way to make a living
at
while you
know,
try
right.
to do it.
Right.
Because understand right from the beginning that it's going to be a process of rejection. I have a theory of rejection.
Oh, yes.
That it isn't rejection. That when you are turned down for something, especially in this field where you're turned down for a role.
Right.
There's two things that happen. You learn and grow from the audition process.
Right.
Well, maybe it's three things. People get to see you and you never know
That's
when
right.
they're going to say, hey.
You, right. I remember I saw you, right.
And it happens all the time.
Yeah.
But more than that, it's take the mindset that you're being released for something else.
Yeah.
And it's not rejection. It's you did this and now you're released.
And you're available.
And you're available. And when you go into an audition, you're not, you go in with the mindset that the director has a problem and you have the solution.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not smart enough to see that you can solve the problem, too bad for them, you're going somewhere else.
And solve somebody else's
yeah.
problem. Yeah.
Right. And that's the truth, too. Directors have a problem and they really want you
yeah.
to be good.
Right.
With the Fiddler thing right now, the woman who had the lead in Little Women has the lead in is Golda. I never in a million years expected her to be able to do that part. I gave her a callback that really was a courtesy callback.
Wow.
I didn't expect her to do it. I had four other women who were ahead of her on my list.
Wow.
And she just knocked me over with her. She was prepared mm-hmm. for the audition. She did her homework.
Okay, so you make this point, and I think this may be a really good place to stop, that you keep trying. You keep going for it,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you never know, right?
No, and you're going to get turned down, and you're going to get turned down, and you're going to get turned down.
And then? Maybe.
Oh, it'll work.
It'll work.
I don't know anybody who's failed if they stick it out.
That is a good place to stop.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Carol.
Thank you. This has been fun.
So there you have Carol Kleinberg, who is the poster child for my show and what it is that I'm trying to do with this show. Over and over and over again, I talk about the importance of finding ourselves, knowing ourselves, discovering ourselves, and then being able to become whoever it is that we actually are. And as you know, if you've been listening, I talk a great deal about how we are encouraged to create a cover story in our early life. And often that means that we are being discouraged from actually creating a story that is the real story of our life. So we are encouraged to lead with certain qualities which somehow either fit with the family system or make the family comfortable. So you hear in Carol's story that her parents worried that she would not be able to make a living directing theater, that she would starve, right? And so she was encouraged to become a teacher, to go to school and study journalism. She was discouraged from following her, what was clearly integral to her. And yet, somehow she got the strength, the belief, that she could and should follow her internal prompting. This fits me, this works for me, this doesn't fit me, this doesn't work for me. And as she says, life provided her with a bunch of seeming accidents. And of course, Carol and I use the word beschert, which is a Yiddish word which means meant to be. And she talked about a universe which is friendly and which is working for you if you let it, even though you have to be courageous, you have to face and walk through your fear. And this is my holiday show, which is to say that it is coming around the Christmas Hanukkah period of time, and appropriately, I am going to tell you my holiday story. This is my holiday story because it happened right around the holiday time several years ago, and I tell it every year. But this year, in conjunction with Carol's story, which is so much about things working out mysteriously, magically, unexpectedly, unintendedly. At this time, the story is even more cogent, even more appropriate. So I'm going to tell you my holiday story, and then I think we're probably going to be at the end of the show. I'm on a plane flying from Sarasota, Florida to Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm sitting next to an older man who looks to me like he's in some distress. And I asked him if he was okay, and he said yes, that he was. A little while later, it looked to me like he was sort of falling asleep and jerking awake, and I asked him again if he was okay, and he said that he had taken some medication for his back, and he thought that might be having an impact on him. And although he still didn't look good to me, I didn't want to bother him anymore. I didn't want to embarrass him. So I didn't say anything until the plane was descending. And as the plane descended, I looked over at him, and it looked to me like he had fallen asleep with his eyes open. And I really got concerned. And so even though we were descending, I got out of my seat, and I went down to the stewardess and explained that I thought my seatmate might be having a heart attack or a stroke. She put me in her seat and went back to see what to do about him. We landed. I got up and was exiting the plane when the stewardess came over and said my seatmate wanted to see me. She walked me over to him, and he had an oxygen mask on his face. I couldn't see him. But he took my hand and he squeezed it. It was very emotional for me, actually. But I forgot about it, as, you know, as something that happened in the past. Several years went by, and then it was closing in on the holidays, and I met a friend for lunch, someone I don't see that often, and we found this place to meet. And I was returning home, and I passed the Women's Exchange, which is a consignment shop here where I sometimes donate clothing and things. And they have a list of the dates that you can donate. And I thought, oh, hell, let me stop in there and get the list. So I pulled into the parking lot, went in, picked up the list, and then I thought, now I'm here. Let me look at the couches. I mean, I wasn't going to buy a couch, but okay, fine. So I went over, and they've got all these couches, right? And I'm standing in front of this big brown couch. A man came over, stood behind me, and said, do you like that couch? And now, I've been to this place a lot of times. None of the staff has ever come over to ask me if I liked something. But, you know, I said, yeah, I like this couch. And he said, well, I don't think this is good for you. Why not? I said. He said, because you see how wide it is, and you're so short. I don't think your feet will reach the ground. He said, see, I'm tall, and it's good for me. And he sat down to show me that. But I don't think it'll work for you. So I took my shoes off and sat down on the couch and tucked my feet under me, which is how I sit. And I said to him, but you see, this is how I sit, so I think it'd be okay. And he said, you know, a couple of years ago, a woman who sat just like you saved my life on a plane. And of course I said, that's because it was me. And I don't know which one of us was more startled or amazed. We continued to tell the story to each other back and over and over and over. And I remember thinking as I was driving home that the holiday season is a season of miracles. And I remember wondering if maybe there really are still miracles. That being said, let me wish you the happiest of holidays, whatever holiday you celebrate, and even, of course, if you don't celebrate any holiday. I'm wishing you happiness and perhaps a miracle or two, or at the very least, as Carol Kleinberg points out, accidents. Be on the lookout for accidents. So before I close this show, let me, as always, thank the redoubtable Josh Hackney, who has certainly been a gift to me, the man who makes this show sound as good as it does. And when it doesn't sound good, it's not Josh's fault. And as always, let me remind you that if you need any help with recording or computing or IT or web or electronics, then you probably want Josh, and you can get him from going up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. And as always, I hope that you heard something in this show that you can use, something that interested you, maybe something you didn't know or something you knew but had forgotten, even something you disagree with. It is my hope that whatever you heard will bring you back next week, because as always, I will be here, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen. Days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I turning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix